The Senate Committee on Judiciary will come to order. Let the record reflect that we have quorum. I know that Senator Marty has asked to be first on the agenda, but he's finalizing a couple of items. So, Senator Sparks, let's get you out of here.
Thank you.
Senator Sparks, I understand that there is a very, very extensive amendment. No, it's a very... let's get the amendment passed out.
There's a charge per word, isn't
there? There aren't too many in this one.
We won't get very much money in the general fund, Senator Foley.
Come on.
Very extensive.
Technical is the word of this amendment. Apparently, Senator Sparks, there is incomplete sentence that has to be addressed.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Do the members need this amendment to be explained? Senator Betzel, this looks like the kind of amendment that you would catch.
This is my kind of amendment.
Yes, and you too, Senator Higgins. That's right.
Pontius.
Yeah, English is my second language, so I rely on the rest of you.
Of course.
Are we amending the first engrossment?
No.
State the place.
22. No. If the applicant fails to return the permit, it's a sentence, period.
That's not a sentence.
It's not a sentence.
It's not a sentence if we put the comma back in and take the period.
You reinstate the comma, take out the period.
Yes,
and you can't cap the, and lowercase the word T. Yeah,
that happens automatically. That happens. Yeah, it's just, that you don't need amendment for, right?
Ms. Pontius, why don't you walk us through the amendment? Since
you found it, you
it took
it.
Us a long time Rammer to get to it.
Oh, yeah. Madam Chair, members, this was actually something spotted by the engrossing office, not me. And they just said there was an incomplete sentence that was in the introduced bill, and this just combines the two parts together into one sentence.
Do we need to have a discussion on this amendment?
So moved.
Senator Higgins, move incorporation of the A1 amendment to Senate File 167. Any discussion? Any member in the audience would like to testify on this amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. The motion is adopted. Now, Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and thank you for catching that major... obviously, we realize the revisor's office, the engrosser's office is very busy, but I appreciate you doing that. Anyway, it's my pleasure to be in front of you today and present Senate File 167. It's the unemployment insurance bill. Just a brief overview, a little history for those of you members that were here last year. This bill was passed off the Senate floor by a vote of 62-0 last year. It met a little snag in the House of Representatives, but we're going to try it again this year. This bill is a consensus product of the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council, which is made up of the AFL-CIO, the Teamsters, the State Chamber of Commerce, the National Federation of Independent Businesses, Mechanical Contractors Association, the Jobs Now Coalition, and Legal Aid. Madam Chair and members, the bill is overall cost neutral. And with that, to walk through the few articles that you would like to see today is Mr. Lee Nelson, the Director of Unemployment Insurance Legal Affairs.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Nelson. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I am the Director of Legal Affairs for the Unemployment Insurance Program in Minnesota. I understand this committee wanted to look at three particular sections of this bill. Article 1, Section 11 deals with personal liability for unemployment insurance debts that may be incurred by a corporation or a limited liability company. What this bill is doing is changing the appeals process. The appeals process is actually being changed in a number of different sections in Article 1, actually in Section 3, 8, 9, and 10, in addition to 11. The current process is inconsistent. in the statute in the sense that certain types of determinations go on certain steps and other types of determinations have an additional step. What we would like to do is streamline the whole process so that every type of determination is handled the same if somebody wishes to contest it. The department would make an initial determination, the person would contest it and go immediately to a hearing before an unemployment law judge, and then in the further step. This is currently the way that all benefit determinations are. But there are only a couple of types of tax issues which have this additional step in it. It creates confusion, and it's expensive, and we would like to eliminate it. In addition, it changes the appeal period from 20 calendar day or from 30 calendar days down to 20. That is being done in probably 30 other sections of this bill. Minnesota has a very long appeal period. Wisconsin's is actually 14 days. Minnesota, for years, most things had a 15-day appeal period. We were simply looking to shorten the appeal period so we get to things faster. People can now file an appeal by internet, by phone. They don't have to do it by mail, so they can get to things quicker and easier. We think we can shorten the appeal time period, and there is no objection from the interest groups. I should also tell you there is another provision of this bill which requires that the determination set out the exact day and date that it will become final, so that it will say it will become final unless an appeal is filed on Tuesday, March 14th. That's in another section of this bill. Article 1, Section 17 provides an amendment dealing with evidentiary hearings. Under current law, if the appealing party does not appear at a hearing, the respondent, the unemployment law judge, still has to conduct the hearing with the respondent only. And if they could appear with witnesses, you could have a hearing lasting for hours, and the appealing party doesn't appear. The unemployment law judge has to issue a full decision, even though the appealing party may well have abandoned the case. Currently, 10% of all appeals filed are withdrawn. Many times parties don't bother to notify us of withdrawn, they just don't bother to appear. And unemployment law judges under current law are required to still conduct a full hearing with just the respondent. This would give the unemployment law judge the discretion to basically dismiss the appeal if the appealing party does not bother to participate. Article 3, Section 20 is just incorporating a cross-reference. Under current law, Section 256.978, the Department of Human Services has the right to obtain unemployment insurance data. We simply want to put that in the unemployment statute so we can find it. Some of our current employees don't even know Human Services has the authority to obtain this information and can't ever find it because they can't ever find that reference. We simply want to reference it in the unemployment law that Human Services has the authority to obtain this information. It does not change current law in any way. And that concludes my remarks on the three sections the committee was looking for. If there's nothing further, I'll take any questions.
Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Nelson, I've got a question. The whole package is Sections 1 to 102 are effective September 30th, 2007. It's shortening the appeals time period from 30 to 20 days. What happens to those cases that are heard towards the end of August 2007? Do they have 30 days or 20 days to appeal during that transition?
Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, any determination issued prior to September 30th, they have 30 days to appeal. Any determination of any sort issued after September 30th will be a 20-day appeal period. But in addition, it will also state again the day and date it becomes final. Currently, all determinations simply say that it will become final in 30 calendar days. And you'd be surprised how many people don't realize that there's 31 days in January and think if something was mailed on January 5th, they have until February 5th to appeal when they actually only have until February 4th. And we end up dismissing hundreds of appeals a year because people screw up the time limit.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, Mr. Nelson, is there any reason why you couldn't do that now or do that prior to the effective date of this bill start telling people here's how long you've got to get your appeals in?
Mrs. Nelson?
Madam Chairman, Senator Betz, there's nothing legally which prohibits it, but our systems. Part of this bill and why it's effective all September 30th is we have a new computer system coming on board. That's one of the reasons the importance of this bill. It's a very expensive technology project, which is currently is already built and is now being tested. And to just, I'm told, very expensive if we were prior to this new system coming on board to have that printed on every type of determination. We issue a million appealable determinations a year of all sorts. Every applicant gets at least two, and we have 200,000 applicants a year. So there are probably 750,000 appealable documents. So that it's impossible for us to do under our current systems. When our new system comes on, that's already been designed and built and is currently being tested. So that's why it hasn't been done to date. Is a systems issue.
So
follow up, Senator.
Just
Betzel.
Want to follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. Assuming that you're not going to wait till September 30th to just turn on the machine and find out if it works. If the new system is up and running before September 30th, couldn't you start putting the notices on before then?
Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, determinations are all being redesigned, being reformatted, redesigned. Then we'd have to go in and redo our old system to make those changes. That's what I'm told. We can't, like I say, it's a whole new system. Could we print just those determinations under the new system and implement parts of the system prior to September 30th? I don't know that answer. I'm not a technical person whether we can implement parts of this whole new system prior to September 30th. I don't know.
Mr. Nelson, at the rate that you're going in implementing the computer system, will it be ready for implementation by September 31st?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am told it will be done by September 30th. That is the last meetings I attended last week. They are still on schedule and on budget.
Very good. Senator Olson, did you have a question? No. Any other questions for Mr. Nelson or for Senator Sparks? Senator Higgins moved that Senate File 167, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Economic Development and Budget Division. I have been informed that.
To the Finance Committee.
To the Finance Committee?
The budget divisions are all under the Finance Committee.
So all right, then be referred to the Finance Committee.
Right.
Madam Chair, Senator Tomassoni has requested to see the bill.
Yes, Senator Sparks. Okay. What I've just been clarified for me is that we refer it to the Finance Committee, and that it will be sent to Senator Tomassoni's.
Okay, I understand. Okay,
committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Before we vote on this, is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify either for or in opposition to this bill? All right. Seeing none, and there's no further discussion on Senator Higgins' motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposing say nay. Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Senator Marty.
A partisan.
I was trying to reach your button in the other committee, and my eyesight Marty wasn't bill. Good enough to read it.
Welcome to the committee, Senator Marty. You have Senate File 147.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I may have an amendment to it, but I wanted to start out with the testimony, explaining the concept and so on, and then discuss it with the committee and so on.
Senator Marty, in the discussion, are you going to be discussing the content of the amendment?
Well, you can distribute it. It's not like it's top secret or anything.
Right.
The A2 amendment might as well. Whether that's the language to use or not, I want to float the idea. The issue here is how we deal with communications in a 12-step support group, like Alcoholics Anonymous or similar support groups. Right now, we have Chapter 595, we have several exemptions for who can be compelled to testify in court, spousal privilege, attorney-client privilege, other things like that. And this bill, as you can see, has introduced persons attending a 12-step support group meeting cannot be called to testify about disclosures made by themselves or others. And also one other provision, you could make statements according to steps 4 and 5 of a recovery program, which you're supposed to admit to some other person what you've done. You can't be examined in a court of law. And I have two people. First of all, this bill has been endorsed by National Association of Addiction Professionals and the Johnson Institute and, I believe, Minnesota Association of Treatment Programs. At least two of those three have letters in your packets, I believe. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Michael Graham, who can explain what he does and why we need the bill, and maybe take testimony, and I'm happy to take questions before or after that.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, is this not Senator Marty's amendment?
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, yes, it is my amendment. I didn't want to offer the amendment yet. I want to.
Because, Madam Chair, one of my questions was going to be about, are you limiting to the 12-step format? And I see the amendment
tightens up some of that.
But it also opens it perhaps to some other kind of programs. I mean, I don't have problems with that.
Senator Marty has asked us to pass this out, but hold on to it. So can you hold on to that thought, and we'll let them testify, and then we'll come back?
Madam Chair, Senator Marty. I think Mr. Braham can talk about, because the support groups, I mean, the group counts and group therapy sessions are already probably covered based on court case. But I'll have Mr. Braham.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Michael Braham. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My comments are 3 or 4 minutes in length, and I'll be happy to stand for questions either during my presentation or afterwards. I'm the person that came up with the language for this bill. I've been working on it for 2 years and secured the endorsements for it. And I wrote the comments that you have in front of you. I, by way of background, I have received my BA from Northwestern University in 1978, my law degree from DePaul University College of Law in 1981, and I practiced law in the Twin Cities for 20 years. Then I went back to school and got my master's degree in addiction counseling. I am now a licensed alcohol and drug counselor at the University of Minnesota Medical Center Fairview, where I counsel adult chemical addicts. However, this legislation that I've been working on is wholly apart from my employment. By way of background, the United States Supreme Court said in Trammell versus the United States, a 1980 case, that it is a human truth that there is a need to disclose to a spiritual counselor in total and absolute confidence what are believed to be flawed acts or thoughts and to receive priestly consolation and guidance in return. The 12 steps of recovery are a spiritual program that assists people in recovering from their drug and alcohol addictions. 6 of the 12 steps reference God or a higher power. The last step says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we attempt to practice these principles in all our affairs. And 2 of the steps require disclosure of one's flawed acts and deeds. My proposal is that the statutory privilege exist for what is said in a 12-step support group meeting and said in the course of the performing of steps 4 and 5. In other words, what's said in those contexts could not be testified to in court. So it's a testimonial privilege. There are at least 7 reasons that I can think of why this is necessary. First, the 12 steps are used by countless treatment facilities as a therapeutic model for change. We use it at the University of Minnesota Medical Center. Hazelden uses it, as do many other treatment facilities. Second, in 1990, the federal government did a study called Project Match, where it evaluated the efficacy of 3 different therapeutic models for treatment: cognitive behavioral therapy, motivational enhancement therapy, and the 12 steps. And what the government found was that in the short term, The treatment outcomes using each of those therapies was virtually the same, but there was evidence to suggest that in the long run, the 12 steps had better treatment outcomes. Third, and perhaps most important, this amendment would protect two segments of the recovery community that are not protected, namely those people without health care insurance who can't afford to go into a treatment facility and avail themselves of the privilege that is accorded between a licensed alcohol drug counselor and their patient. In other words, if you are lucky enough to have insurance and can sit in front of a licensed counselor at a facility, you get a privilege and are protected, whereas if you don't and are not able to, you don't have that protection. And the second part of the recovery community that would be protected would be those persons who are not affiliated with a traditional church. And in that situation, people affiliated with a church are able to avail themselves of the cleric parishioner privilege. But otherwise, they would not have that privilege. So, in other words, people down at the Union Gospel Mission who don't have health insurance or aren't affiliated with a church would be protected in this situation. The fourth reason is society benefits, obviously, from a healthy populace. A 1998 study indicated that society spent $143.4 billion on the costs related to addiction in terms of health care costs, lost productivity on the job, and criminal justice costs. The fifth reason is the Andring case. In State v. Andring, our Minnesota Supreme Court has already decided that privilege applies in group therapy settings conducted in a hospital-type situation. This amendment simply extends the Andring case into the self-help realm. Six, numerous studies show that AA membership, and I've cited these in my materials to you, that AA membership and participation positively correlates to longer-term sobriety rates. And finally, I would submit that the legislation does not harm society in any way. If the privilege is not accorded, then presumably incriminating evidence that might come out in a 12-step meeting is not available. On the other hand, if the privilege is granted, that information is likewise just as unavailable, yet there's a therapeutic benefit achieved. And I emphasize to the committee members what our Supreme Court said in Andring. To the extent that there may be an occasional loss of important information that might be relevant, that occasional loss is outweighed by the therapeutic benefit to society by having the group therapy privilege. So basically, in a nutshell, what Senator Marty has helped propose here with me is that the privilege from group therapy simply be overlaid into the 12-step setting. And Dr. Abraham Verhofsky is here to testify as to the medical reasons for the legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Why don't we hear from Dr. Verhofsky, and then we'll have the members ask questions. Okay. Dr. Verhofsky, please restate your name for the record.
I'm Abraham Verhofsky. I'm a physician licensed by the state of Minnesota to practice medicine. I am a graduate of the University of Minnesota, and I'm a board-certified psychiatrist. I have been in private practice and work at various area hospitals, and one of my subspecialties is chemical dependence. As I am sure you all know, chemical dependence is recognized as an illness. It's been recognized as such by the American Medical Association in 1954, I believe. It's also recognized by the American Psychiatric Association and the World Health Organization as an illness. It is not a mere pattern of voluntary behaviors. It is caused by and in turn causes changes in brain chemistry. It affects about 10% of Americans. Studies have shown that the effectiveness of talk therapy both individually and in group settings. I've also had a chance to read excerpts of court opinions recognizing the privilege in group therapy settings. It is only natural that the same be applied for 12-step meetings. The second A in AA stands for anonymous. Members of the group count on what on that when they open up and talk about their shortcomings and their deeds in an effort to recover from their addictions. If anything is done to jeopardize that, if people don't feel safe in these settings, they will not disclose and will receive no benefit from this therapeutic modality.
Any questions for Senator Betzel?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I guess I need some further clarification. We currently have in statute, and it's listed in the bill we have before us, 595.02, a number of long-recognized privileged communications. It's husband and wife, attorney-client privilege, physician, patient, and so forth. Subdivision I, which is on the basic bill on page, starting page 3, already recognizes communications with a licensed chemical dependency counselor. However, that is not completely unqualified. It does say that, for example, if the communications reveal contemplation or ongoing commission of a crime, that is not protected. Would this language, either the amendment or the language we have before us, be much broader than that? If somebody in a 12-step meeting started, you know, talking about details about the commission of an unrelated crime or contemplation or some ongoing crime, would that be privileged, whereas the same discussions with a licensed chemical dependency counselor would not be exempted?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel.
Mr. Brayman.
Thank you. First of all, provision related to alcohol and drug counselors says that they may, it's not a shall, that they may disclose that information. Second, this particular proposal does not, at least the original version, does not touch upon that issue. That's an open issue that's been around since the Andring case. So what the initial proposed language does only talks about what can be testified to. So, for example, a mandated reporter in a 12-step meeting could, under my proposal, the original proposal, theoretically walk out, follow someone out to their car, get their license plate, and make a report. However, that person under my proposed language would not be allowed to testify as to what the admissions were, which would be consistent with the Child Abuse and Reporting Act, because the public policy of that statute is to intervene and not apprehend the perpetrator. It's to protect. And furthermore, if you look at CARA, the Child Abuse Reporting Act, and in particular Subdivision 8, it talks about when privileges under 595.02 do not apply in a child abuse and neglect setting. And what the legislature has previously decided is that the husband-wife privilege and doctor-patient privilege and social worker privilege do not apply in a litigation involving child abuse or neglect. They have decided, at least apparently for a public policy reason, that licensed alcohol and drug counselor privilege is not waived in those proceedings. So coming back full circle, someone could theoretically make the report while they could not testify as to what they heard. So intervention could occur, protection could occur, but presumably prosecution could not occur.
Senator Betzel.
Mr. Bram, okay, let me again take another look at this. The current language says a licensed chemical dependency counselors shall not disclose information or an opinion based upon information which they acquire from persons consulting them in their professional capacities. They may do so, you know, if there's circumstances that would violate the law, resulting in clear and imminent danger, when the communications reveal contemplation or ongoing commission of crime. They may do so if there's a danger to the public. Is that correct?
Let me explain it.
Mr. Brayman, I am an attorney too.
Yeah, I think
I can read what the statute says. Why does the statute not say that?
Does not say what?
That they may not disclose information based on information they acquire from persons consulting them in their professional capacities, but they may do so when the communications reveal contemplation or ongoing commission of a crime, as an example. They can do that.
They can. If they choose.
Mr. Brayman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Betzold, the statute is not obligatory. It says that they may make the disclosure. It doesn't say that they shall. So it's within the discretion of the counselor. It doesn't say they can't. It doesn't say they must. It doesn't do either.
So,
Senator Betzold,
let me
intervene here.
Okay.
I think that your exchange is going in the direction that's not what the bill is attempting to do. So let me reframe, see if I understand this correctly. I think typically for those of us who are professionals in any capacity, when we think about privilege, we tend to think about it from a lawyer, client, doctor, patient perspective that's covered under what you were talking about, Dr. Betzold. I think what this bill is trying to say here is it is not the professional that we're looking at. It is the third party that we're trying to cover with the privilege here. That's the expansion, and I think that's the public policy debate that we need to have today. It is whether or not we in this committee want to extend privilege outside of the counselor and the individual to then a third party person who might be present. Because I think, contrary to what Mr. Brayman has suggested, I don't think that the Andring decision has settled that point. And in fact, I think what that has said is that a third person being present at the therapy does not take away the privilege between that individual and the doctor who is involved in that. So it doesn't, though, say anything about the privilege of that third person. So the doctor may not testify, and the information is still protected if the doctor is being compelled to testify. But if that third person is the one who's being compelled to testify, is that person's testimony considered privilege? I think that that's the crux of the bill today, and that's for this committee to discuss.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Betzel.
I'm trying to determine if the language that we have, either in the bill or the amendment, goes much broader than the current privilege that we extend the counselors. It appears to me that it does, because it appears to me that somebody in a 12-step meeting can talk about things that would suggest danger to other people, danger to the public safety, and that would be privileged information, which is broader than what we extend to licensed chemical dependency counselors. That's what it does appear to me that, and I was trying to see if that was what Mr. Brayman understood as well, too.
Senator Betzel, that's my understanding.
Thank you.
And that's the second part of the discussion that we're going to have, is, one, the extension of that privilege, and then secondly, how broad do we want that extension to be? Whether it's in the bill or not, we in this committee have to take up that discussion. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A third area of concern that I have looking at this proposal has to do with objective versus subjective standards when a person is asserting this type of privilege, because it seems to me that a portion of this has to do, the first part of it has to do with people attending a 12-step support group meeting, which would be an objective standard. I mean, you're there at the meeting, and then that would be subject to some other type of proof. But the second part says persons making or hearing statements according to steps 4 and 5 of a 12-step recovery program for the purpose of arresting an addiction, which to me seems like an entirely subjective standard based on what that person later claims they were thinking in terms of the reason why they may have been making that statement. So, for example, if one prisoner is maybe talking to another prisoner about something that he committed, I'm just trying to think of any possible way this privilege might be somehow used, would he then be able to come back later subjectively and say, well, the reason I was making that statement was to get this off my chest because I'm going through, you know, a 12-step program that he's maybe been court-ordered to comply with, and now he's being able to somehow misuse this standard to prevent information from being used against him at a later point.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Brayman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Olson, I suppose that's always a possibility. But I can tell you this. You know, I've been doing this counseling for a while, and I've talked to my peers about it. And when people are honest, that's when they're in recovery. When they're not honest, they're not in recovery. And I suppose it may be subjective, and I know subjectivity does not mean that the issue can't be before the courts. There's, when it comes to fraud, I know from my old fraud litigation, what the representer said or didn't say goes to subjectivity. I didn't practice criminal law, but if I remember right, mens rea may be an issue in criminal law as to subjectivity. So the fact that something may be objective and subjective, I think that's true, but I don't think that undermines the public policy reasons for the legislation.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, maybe this would be a good time for me to explain the A2 amendment and just to put it on the table for your discussion. I had some of Senator Olson's concerns about the steps 4 and 5 provision because, again, what does that? Is there any limit to that? Could you claim anything has that privilege? This A2 amendment has several changes. I'm not sure I'm comfortable with the way it is based on what I've heard from Mr. Brayman, but what Senate Counsel drafted this in such a way that, one, it would sort of codify the Andring decision when we're talking about group therapy. And then when it gets to the self-help group on page 4, line 20 of the amendment, the guts of this would be line 4.22, a participant in group therapy or a self-help group may not testify regarding confidential communication made by or to the participant during a group meeting without the consent of the person, which would limit it to just happening during the 12-step meeting. The one thing that I was discussing, and I guess we should hear from the concerns of those who may be opposed or at least concerned about the legislation as well, is lines 4.25 to 4.27, which the mandatory reporting statutes, I think that may be not 100% clear, but that would be comfort language if it is. And the second part of that, which I think Mr. Graham is saying would hurt the point of the 12-step protection, and that is the voluntary disclosure, which he's suggesting in his original bill we leave up to the court, in effect. If I'm in a group and I confess to some crime and another member of the group would be under this legislation protected from testifying against me in court over it, but nevertheless, could they go and report it to the cops that I said I had murdered somebody or whatever? And I'm kind of torn on that. He's saying that would defeat the purpose of it. But the rest of the amendment, I think, would at least address Senator Olson's concern about the 4 and 5 step part of it, because that could happen anywhere. This would only be conversations in the 12-step program.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Marty. And I guess I would also, I may be mistaken in terms of the 12 steps, but it seems to me that something in my memory about this is something about taking responsibility as well. You know, when you make a confession and then you accept responsibility for your actions. And so I guess without the amendment language, I would be a little bit concerned that someone would be avoiding responsibility for their actions and perhaps being given the opportunity to misuse this to confuse, you know how it goes with evidentiary issues. And if someone somehow makes a confession to someone and then claims that that was being used against him and evidence gets thrown out as a result, I'd be concerned about that. Because it does seem to be somewhat inconsistent with the idea of accepting responsibility, although I can understand the therapeutic reasons why you want to encourage people to do this.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson.
Mr. Brayman.
Thank you. And Senator Olson. I understand what you're saying, but I have to take you back to what the Supreme Court said in the Andrian case. There may be an occasional loss of evidence. I will grant you that. But the therapeutic benefit that's achieved by making these groups safe, it outweighs the occasional loss. And those aren't my words. That's our Minnesota Supreme Court saying that. If a person has done a wrong and they go to a clergy person and they are in a 12-step recovery program, for example, at Hazelden, they have clergy on staff specifically to receive steps 4 and 5. That's who you make a step to. You make it to a clergy person at Hazelden for protection. Okay? So if you have a 12-step person who goes to a clergy person and confesses they're wrong, they're protected. What about the people that don't do that and don't have that opportunity? These are, or don't know how to do that, or the people that never even go to treatment because they're so ashamed and walk into an AA meeting and don't know about privilege. These are the people that we need to get into treatment and help. And, you know, I agree. I don't think there's any question that we may not be able to prosecute someone in the past. I, for something they've done. I agree. But I guess I'm saying to get people into recovery, it's worth it. And I would like to echo what Senator Marty said. If there is someone who talks about something outside of a meeting, this legislation doesn't deal with that. That is so complicated. I think that's an issue that the courts will need to resolve on a case-by-case basis. And I haven't attempted to go there because the public policy issues and speculating about all the possibilities that where how this might happen is just too complex. So I've just limited it strictly to the courtroom setting. And again, there's nothing to prevent someone under this language from going to the authorities. What's prevented is them being able to testify about what they heard.
Members, what I would like is if you have any clarifying questions about the bill itself, let's ask Senator Marty that. But if we were going to dive into the discussion, I'd like to have the other witnesses who are here testify first, and then we can engage in the discussion. Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I've read the opinion, I think almost all of it, of the Andrian case, and it's been a while since I was in law school and or practiced law, and so I haven't read haven't read anything similar to this that I can recall at all. And I don't recall the court talking about purpose statements in statute so much. But I'll tell you, there's warning in here about, now I understand why we don't like purpose statements. Because if you don't say it in your purpose statement, then this court said, then it couldn't be part of the purpose. And it's hard for me to believe that a reporting of abuse, the only purpose is to stop that child from being abused, but we apparently aren't concerned about abuse other children may have sustained, and that we weren't also thinking that there are consequences for the person who committed the abuse. So I just can't get off this. It's really very interesting, and I don't know if others here who have read many more cases than I have ever seen the court talk about the purpose statement before, but now I understand why we might not be better off not doing them.
Well, let's have the other witnesses here come up and give us your testimony, and then we can delve into actually the work of the committee. We have Mr. Cahill from Hennepin County and Mr. Colbert. Is it Colbert or Colbert?
It's actually Colbert.
Colbert. Colbert. Colbert. Welcome to committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Pete Cahill, and I am the managing attorney of the Special Litigation Division of the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, and I'm here today on behalf of the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. Also with me is John Colbert. By way of full disclosure, he is a member of the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, but he is here voluntarily on his own behalf, speaking on his personal experience, not on behalf of the office. With that, Madam Chair, I am here today to testify in opposition to Senate File 147, whether it is the initial version or the A2 amendment. First of all, let me make it clear that I'm not here to in any way disparage or devalue 12-step programs. They perform an important function in society. They perform an important function for people to maintain sobriety. I've been present in court both as a prosecutor and defense lawyer when hundreds of people have been ordered, involuntarily even, to attend 12-step programs, and some have been helped tremendously by them. So I don't want you to interpret my remarks today in any way disparaging the work of 12-step programs. My concern first is I'm not sure what evil here, what problem is intended to be remedied. In the over 22 years that I've been practicing criminal law, I have never been present in a trial or any court proceeding where someone has been subpoenaed to testify about communications made during a 12-step group meeting of any type. So I'm not sure what it is we're trying to attack here. And the problem is that this language has a severe potential for abuse. And I'm not talking about people who in good faith are attending 12-step meetings. It's the definition of a meeting, and it's the definition of a member that can cause others to claim that their communications were in that context. And I note particularly Senator Olson's example of maybe two prisoners talking to each other. If I could for a moment digress to one 12-step program is obviously Alcoholics Anonymous. And in the book, The 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, under Tradition 3, it is written that any two or three alcoholics gathered together for sobriety may call themselves an AA group. So while we may be thinking, as we're discussing here, that a group meeting is a large collection of people on a weekly basis and it's published, that is not the only type of meeting. Two people who are members of a 12-step program who are talking to each other could be considered a group meeting under the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. And furthermore, it is not up to the court, it is not up to the government to state who is a member of AA. Again, from the three traditions, it says that, quote, any alcoholic is a member of AA when he says so, end quote. My concern is situations, one example given by Senator Olson, you have two prisoners talking to each other or two gang members out on the street talking to each other about their crimes, and if it is somehow disclosed and one is going to testify, they merely have to say that they are members. There's nothing the court can really do to oppose that, or the prosecution can do to oppose that, because by its definition, people are members of a 12-step program, or at least AA, when they say so, not when the government says so. And furthermore, if they together would say, well, we're talking for the purpose of sobriety, and they're abusing that privilege, and they're trying to cover their tracks, and they're not acting in good faith, there's nothing really the state, the prosecution, or any litigant on either side can do, because the traditions provide if two are talking, it's their meeting, and it's up to them to say whether or not they, in fact, are members. I think this has a great potential abuse, especially for sophisticated career criminals who know how to work this type of a privilege, and I don't think there's any evil out there that needs to be remedied by such a broad application of privilege doctrine. I would note, however, that there is a difference between the self-help groups that we object to and the group therapy sessions. As in the Andring case and what appears to be the definition in the A2 amendment, that is obviously much less objectionable, and I just got this, so I don't know if we have any objection at all, to be honest, because group therapy is run by licensed professionals who have codes of ethics, who are subject to discipline and regulation, and who can set the boundaries for what is a group therapy meeting and what is not, and what can be disclosed and what cannot. And they are all, of course, mandatory reporters under child abuse laws and vulnerable adult reporting laws. And so there are good boundaries there, and it is much more easy to set out the limits of this privilege. I think if you contrast it with the traditions of 12-step groups, it is, would be much harder to do so. And so I would hope at the very least that the self-help groups are taken out, and at best, you protect what's done in group therapy by licensed professionals. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Very good. Mr. Colbert, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. As Mr. Cahill said, I'm a law school student, first of all, at Hamlin Law School, and I am an employee at Hennepin County. I also am in recovery and an active participant in a 12-step group. I'm not in any way talking on behalf of Alcoholics Anonymous or any 12-step group for that matter. I can speak only from my personal experience. I have been in recovery and been sober for over 7 years. I've been to probably over 1,000 AA meetings. I sponsor numerous people. I've sponsored people over the years. I've heard numerous fourth and fifth steps. And it's my understanding that this 12-step legislation is a little bit broad. I agree with what Mr. Cahill said, and the potential for abuse is large. I can talk about Alcoholics Anonymous specifically only because that's where it's my understanding that all 12-step groups have, that I know of, have adopted the same 12 steps that come out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Alcoholics Anonymous has been functioning as its own entity for over 70 years without legislation of this type. I have never run into any situations where I would need to disclose, have been asked to disclose anything like that. It's my opinion that the farther that any 12-step group is away from the state, I think the better off that both entities are. I think there is a public purpose in AA, and I think in hearing fifth steps, as one of the senators alluded to, taking responsibility for your actions is a large portion of what we do, and that comes in step 9 when we make amends for the wrongs that we've done. So I don't see any reason why this is necessary simply because of the long duration that 12-step programs have been functioning without it, and how well that they're functioning without it right now. And my experience is that it's changed my life. I've seen it change numerous other people's lives, and I've experienced working with other people who it's changed their lives as well. So,
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
There was one other point I wish to make, and that was the concern over the uninsured. Obviously, we don't want to cut off help to the uninsured, but in drug court in Hennepin County every day, the uninsured are provided with chemical dependency treatment through the Rule 25 process. So I think we should fund that as opposed to saying a 12-step program is all we're going to give you. It's a good thing to give them, but it shouldn't be the only thing. And we should continue to fund it so that people who are uninsured can get chemical dependency treatment. Thank you.
Any questions, members, to the two witnesses? Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Marty, what do you want to do with your amendment?
Madam Chair, when Senate Counsel was trying to come up with definition of self-help group, that's one of the things we were wrestling with. I don't know. I think it may. I mean, I understand the concern about how broad it is, and maybe there is a way to come up with a tighter definition. I think the reason, and again, I'm not the expert in chemical dependency. I agree with Mr. Cahill. We ought to fund the chemical dependency treatment issues, and I don't think this is meant as a response to that. But I do think it is. It's very important that we try and make it so people can use these groups in an open, honest way. I do have some concerns about the definition and how we can do that better, so maybe we need to take a look at that, but I'll ask Mr. Brayman for comments as well.
Well, let me ask you this, Senator Marty and Mr. Brayman. I am struck by the testimony from Mr. Cahill with respect to the rationale or why this bill specifically to the 12-step program. Mr. Brayman.
Can you restate your question, please, Madam Chair? I'm sorry, I don't understand it.
Well, what I just heard Mr. Cahill testify was that in his recollection in the 22-some years that he's been in practice, there has yet to be an individual from a 12-step program who has been compelled to come forward and testify. And so usually when we put legislation in place is to respond to an issue that's outstanding.
Right.
And so what is what's the impetus for this? And then why a 12-step support program in particular? Why not, you know, group therapy or you know, a category as opposed to this program specifically?
Right. I'd be happy to answer that, Madam Chair. First of all, I think that what Mr. Cahill said is kind of a two-edged sword for his argument, because the very fact that this hasn't come up for him indicates that there would be no harm in granting the statute. The reason that I came up with this language in particular is there is case law around the country where this issue has come up, and in particular the case of Cox v. Miller out of the Federal District Court in New York. In that case, the issue came up whether or not the members' disclosure, fellow members' disclosure, could be used to apprehend Mr. Cox. And the federal district court said that the statements were protected on the basis of the cleric parishioner privilege. And they said it was that was, and then it went up to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals reversed that, saying it wasn't, they weren't going to protect the statements made in the AA meeting on the basis of the cleric parishioner privilege because Mr. Cox was not specifically seeking cleric advice. However, what the court did say was, we understand that there are good reasons why confidentiality may be a necessary prerequisite for the efficacy of 12-step groups, but we're not going to be an activist court. We're going to leave this issue to the legislature. And there are other cases besides Cox v. Miller where the same issue has come up. So I think it just because it hasn't come up here in Minnesota with regard to Mr. Cahill's experience doesn't mean that the issue isn't out there. It is out there. There are a number of cases out there where this issue has come up. An article that Senate counsel forwarded to Senator Marty that was passed on to me by the Journal of Legal Medicine has their own model provision language for just this provision. This is not unique. Second, why just 12-step groups? The reason I focus just on 12-step groups is because there is a history. There are traditions behind it. If this privilege was to be accorded to people who are just sitting around the fireplace, I didn't think it would fly. The issue is very narrow in my mind. I'm trying to accomplish a very narrow thing, and that is that people can walk into an AA support group and be comfortable that as Dr. Verhulsky said, that anonymous really means anonymous. And right now, anonymous doesn't really mean anonymous.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Marty, I'm trying to understand this. I don't know much about 12-step programs. I don't know if there's numerous 12-step programs or if there's just one model that fits a variety of scenarios. But looking at the amendment on page 4, line 20, it makes reference to a self-help group means a peer-run group that uses a 12-step approach. And then it also says another option or other format. I'm a little uncomfortable with that reference because I don't think it gives us the specificity that we may require for this type of legislation. And I'm wondering if you or your witnesses could tell me how many 12-step program approaches are there out in the real world, or other formats for facilitating recovery? Is that a rather broad definition, or does that give us a narrow definition?
Mr. Brayman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, I'm not sure what the other format was. That's not my language, so I can't comment on what was thought of by the persons that wrote those words. In terms of 12-step groups, there's basically one model and one model only. There's the 12 steps have been applied, however, to not only Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous, Marijuana Anonymous, Methamphetamine Anonymous, but the steps are essentially the same. So that's what I was thinking of. That's what countless treatment facilities use, and so I was sticking with that because I knew what that is.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lemire.
I hate to do this because I'm always uncomfortable answering these questions, a hypothetical situation. Let's say you had a police officer that was undergoing a Alcoholics Anonymous session. And during the time he's there, he hears someone else in the group admit that maybe as a result of a dependency on alcohol, they realize they did something really bad. And they admit during that time. Now, would this legislation, if passed into law, would that restrict that police officer from using that as evidence?
It would restrict
him. Mr. Brayman.
Sorry, Madam Chair. It would restrict him from testifying about it in court. That's all it would do. Now, what he did with that information and how it could be used would be an issue for the courts to decide. So on one hand, I can, and it's the same issue that, in my opinion, now exists under the State v. Andring case. On the one hand, I can see it being argued that he's free to go and talk to whoever he wants to talk to, and then whatever information the police obtain from that can be used, but he can't testify to it. That would be a very narrow reading of the statute and would be a narrow reading of the Andring case. On the other hand, I could also see it being argued that allowing any evidence that he suggests to anybody could not be used because it would basically eviscerate the privilege. And so I go back to what I stated a little earlier, that this is an issue I think would need to be resolved on a case-by-case basis by the courts in the future. So this provision is strictly related to testimonial privilege, just like all the other testimonial privileges under 595.02.
Madam Chair, one last
hang on.
Question.
Okay.
If the situation were different, let's say it's a small town community where people are well known to one another, not a urban setting where perhaps the participants in that group therapy session may not even know each other, or very little, except for the occasional times they've gotten together. If it wasn't a police officer or it was just a private citizen and they happened to divulge what happened or what was discussed in a meeting, would that just be considered hearsay? Rumor, if it was ever brought to court, could a police officer use that information in a courtroom?
Mr. Brayman?
Senator, your question is that if someone is outside of the meeting and discloses what they heard in a meeting, could that information be used?
Mm-hmm.
And that is an issue that's not attempted to be resolved by this legislation.
Right.
It's very, as I stated earlier, that is so complex, the variations are so numerous, that I think it's something that would need to be resolved by the court.
Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, as I mentioned earlier when I was asking Senate Counsel to look at this, trying to define 12-step programs, I think a lot of us, you know one when you see one. Gamblers Anonymous, there are all kinds of them, but nevertheless, trying to define it in such a way that prevents people from using it is the difficulty. I am wondering if we should take some, not the committee's time, but take some time to try and come up with some better ways to make sure it can't be abused, because I recognize it in what Senator Olson said at the long ago, the beginning of the discussion, that's been a concern, and I think maybe I should take some more time and try and work on that instead of taking more of the committee's time right now. I think the importance of trying to protect what happens in these meetings is very great. I think it is a very important part of, I don't see it as treatment. I see it most often as people who've been through treatment, and now this is sort of their follow-up, their ongoing care. And I think it's very important that we do everything we can to protect its integrity. But again, the difficulty of those definitions makes it hard, and County Attorney's Office is obviously concerned about that, as well as I think the committee and myself and others. But maybe what we should do, maybe I'll ask if you could wait over and let me take a chance, see if I can come up with some way to address that, because we were trying to do that.
Senator Marty, I think that that's a good idea. While the program that's being contemplated and what it's trying to respond to seems on the surface that it's reasonable and that we ought to engage this, the public policy implications for the expansion of privilege and the content and what you do with that is moving in a very serious direction. And I think that those of us who are lawyers in the room and who have had, whether you're a lawyer or not, who've had experience in this area of, you know, privilege and confidentiality, that's a really big area of the law. And I think what your proposal is proposing to do is dramatically moving it in a different direction that would require this committee to be very involved in that discussion. Not that we're not willing to engage in that. That's what we're here for. But if your sense is that, the bill is not where it needs to be for us to be engaged in that conversation, then I appreciate you're continuing to work on this, and we'll definitely give you an opportunity to come back when you think you're in shape for us to take it up. Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, when you come back, just by way of analogy, I'd like you to be prepared to answer some questions. Maybe I should know the answer, but I don't. By way of analogy, if somebody gave confidential testimony to a lawyer, a doctor, or a priest, and they disclosed it, I'd like to know, is there a civil cause of action that you can sue those for the breach, and would that apply here? And secondly, can you use in those kind, even though you don't know the answer right now as to how the courts might decide, you know, kind of the fruit of the poisonous tree, if it's disclosed to somebody, even though that person couldn't testify, could they use the fruits of that if they acquire other evidence? That issue probably has been resolved in the other situations where you're talking about lawyer, priest, or doctor, where that's been disclosed. So if you could be prepared to answer that question if you come back, I'd appreciate it.
Good. Well, thank you, Senator Marty.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Senate File 147 is laid on the table for the time being. Senator Betzold on Senate File 463.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate File 463 is a rather simple bill. It might take a little bit of explanation here. I think, as committee members know, notary publics simply notarize that somebody is whose signature actually appears on a document, is the person who actually signed it. They don't necessarily verify that the information is true. That's the person who signed it has to do that. And by the way, as every legislator is a notary public, that's just one of the things that happens when they swear us in. This bill would propose to raise the maximum fee that a notary public can charge. Now, a notary public is not required to charge anything. I've been a notary for the 27 years that I've been in the private practice of law, and I've notarized hundreds of documents. I don't charge for them. It's just part of the things you do as a lawyer. I've had my signature notarized on things that I have to send out. I've got a secretary or another attorney that will notarize. You just notarize things. And I think that, frankly, in the big scheme of things, I think many notaries do that just as part of the service they offer. However, there are some people that do operate businesses. I don't think there's anybody that would be a full-time notary. I think you couldn't quite make a living doing nothing but that. But people do that, offer services as notaries in addition to other things that they do. The maximum fee that can be charged was set at $1 in 1983. And before that, it was 25 cents. So from 1983 to the present, the fee has only been $1. Now, I will concede that this is a 500% increase going from $1 to $5. However, I will also note that 4 years ago, the charge for a notary commission, by the way, the notary commissions are, the Senate has to confirm notaries. We do that. The charge for notary commission 4 years ago was $25, and then it was raised to $100. So there was a 400% increase for the commission. Now, so somebody who is a notary has had to pay basically, you know, from going from a $25 commission up to $100, and has only been able to charge $1 for if they do charge for services at all. I do have two people who are here who can testify, you know, on the ramification and, you know, what notaries do and how they do things. We have Sue Anderson from Anoka County and Joan Bozen from Olmsted County. And Ms. Anderson, you're listed first. So do you want to go
ahead? Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Anderson.
Thank you. Susan Anderson from Anoka County. I do vital statistics and license bureau administration. And we process several notaries throughout the year. And just for definition, I'd like to read what the duties of a notary are. A notary public is a person of integrity appointed by the governor to serve the public as an impartial and unbiased witness. The most common function of the notary is to prevent fraud by witnessing and attesting that a person signing a document is authentic. The responsibilities of a notary public are critical to the legal, business, financial, and real estate communities in this state and should be taken seriously. You must have an understanding of the proper procedures to follow in order to fulfill your duties. As a commissioned notary, you are a public official appointed to serve the public. Part of your duties are all document signers must personally appear before you, assess whether each document signer is competent. While not responsible for the content of a document, alert the signer to any blanks. Establish the identity of each signer through the personal knowledge, your personal knowledge, or through identification. Have all parties sign the document. Complete the notary certificate. This may include requiring the signer to have a verbal oath or acknowledgement. Use your stamp or seal on the document and make an entry in your notary journal. I'll pass. Madam Chair.
Ms. Bolzen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I just wanted to say a few words about the type of notary services we do in our county. I manage the Olmsted County License Bureau, where we do passport services, driver's licenses, and several other services. And the notary public services has increased quite a bit over the last couple of years. In the year 2006, we served 620 customers. So it is an increasing service that we're finding in our area. And I did bring along with me a chart that we use in our office to determine what type of acknowledgement or notary service we're performing for the consumer. Some of the statements we witness are as simple as a power of attorney, and some of them are as complex as foreign adoption documents. And as Sue mentioned, we do the verification of the person signing the document with going through photo identification processes and so forth.
Ms. Bolzen, currently when you provide those services, do you charge a fee?
We do charge the $1 fee that is set by maximum.
Mm-hmm. And is that for that's for all the different categories that you have listed?
Yes.
And then, Ms. Bolzen, if we do pass this, will there be a fee increase up to that limit for all those services that you are currently performing?
Yes, we would change our fee structure to be the $5.
And Ms. Bolzen, for some of those services that you're currently providing, is there also an application fee that comes along with filing of that document?
No, these are documents that are their personal documents or documents leaving the United States going to a consulate agency. So they're nothing filed and recorded in our office.
Any questions for either the witnesses or Senator Betzold? Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, I'm trying to remember, in the back of my mind, there's something called a medallion.
acknowledgement? Can do you know what that is? And doesn't that apply when you're trying to get a visa or passport?
Ms. Bolzen?
And can you charge more for that?
My question to you would be, are you referring to the seal, the acknowledgement seal of the notary public?
I can't remember exactly what a medallion is, but it's a different kind of notary. Is that?
I'm unfamiliar with that. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Madam Chair, the only seal I know of is using an embossed seal for the county itself as a deputy, or our staff that are notary publics using their pre-ink notary stamp.
What do you call those stampers that you punch in and creates little holes that are like Braille on your document?
That would be the embossed seal.
Oh, the embossed seals.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Foley?
Madam Chair, I only have to raise this issue once, but it's the fees that this, while it's just a small amount, it's one of many that we've been wrestling with, and at some point, sooner or later, we're going to have to reduce fees, not raise them. So, thank you.
Senator Lemmer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Foley, I was doing some quick math, and if we continue on the progress that we are on the scale of increase from 1983, when you retire in 2031, the cost of notary will be $30 if we continue at this scale.
Whoa.
Now, maybe inflation might catch up to us by that.
Is it on this point, Senator Olson? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to just go through my head, off the top of my head, and think of every document I've come into contact in practice that requires a notary, from insurance claims, settlement documents, filing documents with the court. And I'm sure the list could go on, because it's so easy to just say that we want something notarized. There's no requirement that limits someone's ability to request a notarized signature. I think anyone who wants to ask for that can. And so my concern is that when this has been a lower amount, like a dollar, there really hasn't been a financial incentive for anyone to make a business out of asking for this, because it doesn't amount to much. But if you make it five times as much, in almost every public document that we're filing, we're going to be adding a $5 surcharge to that. So I'm just wondering if we couldn't somehow be more reasonable and maybe making it go from $1 to $2 rather than $5.
Sounds like a good idea.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Bolzen.
The one of the things that we've noticed with the influx of documents being presented to us for notarization is it takes 15 to 20 to 30 minutes of duration time for the staff member that's spent on that. In the meantime, the other consumers are waiting in line for passport services, driver's licenses, liquor licenses, and whatever else it is we provide. So it is a very time-consuming task. It depends on what it is.
Mr. Carlson is at the table. Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association. Before I make my comments, I guess I'll answer Senator Neville's question. The medallion service is a signature guarantee service offered by the financial industry. I've utilized those services in the past. If you go to a brokerage or a financial institution, that is what I believe the medallion is that you're referring to. Madam Chair, members, I'm just appearing here in support of this legislation. Our 13-member counties, which do include Olmsted and Anoka counties, have taken a position through our organization in support of this increase. I think what was perhaps neglected to be said is that we don't make our employees pay the commission charge. We, as the employer, pay this for them, and it has been a cost increase for us. The reason why that commission fee was increased back in 2003 was quite frankly, if the members don't know, was to increase state revenues. The consequence was to basically increase local government costs to the extent that we provide these notary services. Absent some other way to recover these costs, such as through the notary fee increase, we frankly have been left with no choice but to increase our levies or to cut expenditures in other areas to recoup these. So we think this is a reasonable way to recoup this cost while at the same time preserving the additional revenues that were generated by the fee increase back in 2003.
Senator Schott.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm going to speak in support of this. I mean, I think we maybe didn't even blink when we raised that commission from $25 to $100, and we probably did a whole list of fee increases that raised money for the state. I don't think anybody – you did over 600 in Olmsted County in a year. That's – you know, something over $3,000. I don't see people making a living. You can go to the bank that where you bank, I think, and at least mine will notarize at no charge for me. This just, if you're taking 15 minutes, trust me, that person's earning more than $4 an hour. We need to do this. This is, so I would say I strongly support this 500% increase.
I wish we would put it that way.
Well, just, I do understand Senator Olson's point. You know, there are sometimes people who have to file papers. They may not have a bank account, and the one place they may end up is the county where they have to go. And, you know, sometimes that $5 is probably their bus ride home. So we should think about that. We should think about that.
Then they should find their legislator who would probably do it for free.
Yeah.
Right. All right. Is there any further discussion on this bill?
Madam Chair, I don't know if anybody else is here on this bill or not. I have not been.
Is there anybody else in the audience here to testify? They're for or against this bill. Mm-hmm. Senator Betzel?
I'm not aware of this bill having to go anywhere else, so, Madam Chair, I will move the Senate file 4-6.
Madam Chair, I'm Scott Simmons, Association of Minnesota Counties. The AMC organization also supports the bill. I should just note for the committee, there is a process by which these fee increases would be enacted at the local level. It's not an automatic increase. These are flexible increases that would only come after a county board would authorize a fee schedule. Keep in mind that the bill is flexible. It doesn't mandate a $5 fee. It authorizes up to $5. So each county may choose on its own whether to raise the fee from $1 to anywhere up to $5.
Thank you. Anybody else who wishes to testify on this bill? All right. Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, I have not been advised that this bill needs to be seen by anybody else, so I will move that Senate File 463 be recommended to pass.
On Senator Betzel's motion, any further discussions? See none. On Senator Betzel's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
No.
No. Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel, should I recess for a little bit?
Madam Chair, I have been advised. I have a doctor who's available to testify on my next bill. I do have a message that she called at 4:20. She is on her way. She's not here yet, but that will help me in presenting the bill if she's here. So
the committee will stand in recess until the call of the chair.
She got kind of wrapped up with everything else and forgot about it. And then the MCC.
I don't know. We're on and
talking
to
grocers tonight.
So they went over the house.
I'm getting my little seal.
They basically
there. But we don't have a seal.
I
didn't remember a line.
No one else pushing their pants.
You don't need it.
Well,
so I also made me nervous. She said we're supposed to keep a log.
I try to get her to at least
do something
on the bill and see what happens.
I do.
Spend so much time doing things too.
Yeah,
so.
You have to keep a log.
Yes, and I was a lawyer.
Don't keep a log of every dog tag.
You're right.
Neither do I.
Some military
voting. My wife doesn't like to go
anywhere.
I don't know anybody who keeps a log.
The Senate Judiciary Committee will come back to order. We have in front of us Senate File 322, Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I thank you for the accommodation to accommodate my witness, who's a physician and had to come in from the clinic in Minneapolis to testify in this bill. Members of this committee and other committees might recall seeing a similar bill that we had actually in the last legislative session. The bill actually went through this committee and the Health Committee, and then the Budget Division was stalling over in the House, and that's why it wound up not being adopted into the omnibus Health and Human Services budget bill. But I recognize that many people may not have seen it or have forgotten about it. I'll briefly explain the genesis of this bill and what this does. In my life as an attorney, one of the things I do a lot of is represent individuals in the civil commitment process. And we have laws that are quite stringent about the standards for civilly committing somebody, either from mental illness or chemical dependency. And in order to be committed to as a chemically dependent person, it requires that they have to have a habitual and excessive use of drugs or alcohol, wind up being a danger to themselves or others, wind up being unable to provide for their basic needs of food, clothing, shelter, medication. And there are some folks that, Frank, we don't try to civilly commit everybody who has a drinking problem. We can't. The resources aren't there, and there's no need to. But some people, frankly, are just so out of control that they need to be civilly committed. It was called to my attention that there is a and we actually, by the way, have statute, part of the civil commitment law, does allow civil commitment of pregnant women who are on crack. And so we do have some precedent in law dealing with that. This issue came to my attention. There's a group of women who are, when they're pregnant and they're abusing drugs or alcohol, it is pretty well established that that abuse can lead to fetal alcohol syndrome. Now, the problem that we have is that many of the women that we're talking about may be abusing it and clearly abusing drugs or alcohol, but not quite to the extent that they are so much of a danger to themselves or other people to qualify for civil commitment. There's clear dangers to the fetus and with fetal alcohol syndrome. But so civil commitment process does not quite work there. Now, we do have something in the civil commitment law that provides for early intervention. Actually, I was the author of that provision in the civil commitment law that was mainly written for people who are mentally ill, and the bill actually adds on to the early intervention law. But that was written because with many mentally ill individuals, they're going down the slippery slope. They're stopping their medications. They're starting to be, say, psychotic. There's the illness is manifesting itself, but they haven't hit rock bottom. So early intervention was devised to give a short-term treatment. And it is not part of the you don't see the sections in the bill, but Ms. Pontius has provided the early intervention parts of the statute in her summary, so that for a very short period of time, a court could order a person into treatment for up to 21 days. And the idea of early commitment is a lower standard for early intervention in a short period of time, just so basically to bump somebody on track who really needs it. But early intervention, as I say, was originally written for the persons who suffer from mental illnesses. I adopted that concept for this bill for early intervention for pregnant women who need it solely for the purposes of if they're using the alcohol, inhalants, or whatever that would be leading to the damage to the fetus, just to give the physicians the opportunity to kind of bring them in, give them some short-term treatment, and then with the idea that then they'd be releasing them. Now, that's why I wanted to bring Dr. Lydia Karos in, because she deals with these cases all the time, and she can give you a bit of her background, some of the things that she's seen, and why she believes that this bill is necessary, and some of the things that maybe she might be able to accomplish if this bill is there. So.
Dr. Carrolls, welcome to the committee. We're glad that you're able to make it.
Thank you very much. And sorry I was late getting here. The clinic was a little bit wild in the end of the afternoon. Just when you think you're going to get out, those inconsiderate sick children just mess it up. I want to tell you just a little bit about how we do things at the clinic just as a lead-in to this, and I'm trying to get my mind straight, too, after racing over here. We are a community clinic, and we've been working on this issue for about 18, almost 20 years now, where we've instituted a very careful prenatal screening for alcohol and other drug use during pregnancy. And you should know that most places are not doing this. We're actually working on trying to spread this out there so that other clinics will start instituting this as a regular practice. But what we do is when we first have a pregnant woman who comes in and gets her first pregnancy test, is that we do a series of screens on this woman to get an assessment of where she's at and her risk for this pregnancy. And we do a pretty thorough chemical use screen. We ask her about what her general pattern for drinking was before she knew she was pregnant. And that's a very important piece because that's kind of clear of any of the shame or guilt about I'm pregnant but I'm still drinking. So we ask, how many times a week do you drink? How much do you drink? Or how much did you drink before you knew you were pregnant? And so they put that information down, and then we say, and how much are you using since you've known you were pregnant? And we get that on everybody. And quite frankly, we look at what they said their pattern was before, almost more seriously than we look at what they tell us about right now, because every woman wants to do it right. Every woman wants to do the right thing and have a healthy baby. But we know based on her previous patterns what the risk is. And in addition to that screening, we also check for are you being in a domestically abusive situation right now? How much support do you have at home? Does your partner drink? All the other risk factors to get a handle on how much stress is this woman going to be under during this pregnancy? How much risk is she to fall back into the pattern that she had before she was pregnant or before she knew she was pregnant? So we're obsessive about this at the clinic. And what we found when we started doing this screening was that almost 70% of the pregnant women drank during the first trimester. And if we hadn't asked these questions, we would never know that. So that's a lot of kids over a period of time. So that we've made a big focus on making sure that we look at what kind of supportive services does this woman need. How can we help her with the domestic abuse issue if that's what's going on? How can we help her get a Rule 25 or get treatment if that's what it looks like right off the bat? And we also give FAS education at that time about the risks of drinking, what it does to a child's brain. So it's very, very clear that during pregnancy it damages developing cells, and that every single drink adds more potential damage. No matter what time of the pregnancy is, the central nervous system is developing from minute one to birth, and at any point in time that a woman's drinking, she can cause further damage. On the flip side of that, any time you can get a woman to decrease her drinking or stop her drinking or not be drinking for that period of time, you've protected that child from further damage. What we found is that even though about 70% of the women are using in that first trimester when we see them, once we've done our spiel here and have tried to do the support piece and the education piece, that only about 5% ever talk about drinking again. I mean, that are saying, yes, I drank the last time. Because we ask them at every single prenatal visit if they've had any drinking since we saw them last. And I want to add, too, that as part of this, we make a point that it's not about shaming, it's not about blaming. We are very respectful and caring about these women in the way that we ask this. We're not jumping to report them, and we have to report the cocaine, but they know that we're not there to try and do a punishment thing or a controlling thing. That is not what it's about. It's about trying to support her, get her help, and to protect that baby. So what we found, again, is that very few women continue to drink once we've done this and try to put in these supportive services. And then there are some that we find that, yes, you know, the last time, since the last time I was here, I drank the other night because this and that happened. And that's a point in time where we'll say, well, let's look at what your triggers are. Let's see how we can get you more support. Maybe it's time to get into treatment. So we're, the majority of the women, this issue here is not, I mean, it's just not something that we need as an immediate response to someone who says they're struggling with this. But there are some women who really, you know, it's beyond just the we need some more support. These are women that clearly need treatment, that are refusing treatment, that don't want to hear about it, can't face it, are in total denial, and we know that it's causing a lot of damage. And it probably doesn't meet the criteria of habitual and excessive. In terms of the pregnant woman, any use at all, in fact, is excessive, but it wouldn't meet this ordinary criteria. So to have a last resort plan to, in a caring way, make sure this woman gets to stop that, you know, take a minute, take several days to reassess, get some help, get a focus again, gives you a chance, as well as those days to protect that fetus again for that period of time, to get the woman the help that she needs. It's not perfect, and we all know that, you know, even some women who have been in treatment a number of times, it doesn't fix them necessarily, especially if you're not dealing with other issues that they're working on. But this would be a very helpful tool for a place with a, in a desperate case where there's no tool now.
Describe your clinic.
My clinic, it's called the Native American Community Clinic. It's on Franklin Avenue. It's a little community, family practice community clinic. We see people of all ages. Anything else? Are there any questions?
Yes.
Sorry, I kind of just threw that out.
Dr. Carroll, we'll have members of the committee ask questions if they have any. Actually, I have a question. Senator Betzel, once an individual has been identified and they go through this intervention treatment process, is the intervention custodial? So, like, they check in to a place for, you know, a week, or is the intervention just getting them to somebody who will talk to them or put them into treatment?
Well, Madam Chair, the most restrictive scenario would be that a court could order early intervention. That is, a court could order that a woman go into some sort of a locked treatment facility, but for a relatively short period of time. I mean, there's most chemical dependency programs are 21 days. That's the maximum time period that this early intervention would even be allowed. So we're not even talking about sending them into a chemical dependency treatment program. But if a court felt that the tests that are stated here, that, you know, there is excessive use of a controlled substance or their derivatives that might be risking damage to the brain or physical development of the fetus, if a court was convinced by clear and convincing evidence that this test was met, then the court could order the person into some sort of a treatment facility. What type of treatment facility would have to be done by the court? I'm not quite sure what would options would be available. There's always detox facilities, if nothing else. If somebody is just so out of control that they need to just basically dry out, that might be an option. If they need to be in a medical facility such as, say, Hennepin County Medical Center, because there are some health issues that seem to be attendant to the dependency, whatever the court felt was the appropriate one. It does not have to be a locked facility, but as I said, the most restrictive thing would be that the court could find just some other place to go and say, I want you to go there, but you're ordered to go there. So, and if you don't, I'll send you somewhere else.
Dr. Carrolls, for the population that you work with, are you in this bill contemplating specific programs that is in existence that you are thinking people who come through your clinic could be sent to or referred to that they would get some help through this legislation?
Yes. And I think, and not just our clinic, I think every medical clinic who's taking care of prenatal women should have something available. I mean, that's part of why a lot of the clinics aren't even screening women or trying to even deal with it, because they don't know what to do when they get someone who really needs help, because they don't know where the help is. And this is one angle of that. So if something like this were available and people had an option about what they could do with these really difficult cases, it would make a difference in identification and treatment.
Well, Dr. Carroll, one of the things that I'm concerned about is that we could pass this, but if there are no treatment programs, to address the needs of these individuals. This is the first step, but, you know, can you tell us that there are treatment programs that are available that would be accessible to these women through this this mechanism?
You mean after they finish the commitment piece?
Yes.
Yes. I mean, I can't guarantee that there's enough for every single person who needs it in the area. In fact, it is something we're working on a regular basis to see what is the level of services based on the need in the community. But there are many treatment places, and there's actually been more money given out at the state level this year for treatment and housing and so on for women who are actually going into treatment. It's the getting them there or getting the woman to realize, you know what, I really do need this. That's the important, if you can't get past there, it doesn't matter how many treatment places you've got, if you can't get them to realizing that that's what they need at that point.
Any other members of the question? Senator Scheid.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I wondered, Doctor, is it Karas?
Karas.
Karas.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also asking Senator Betzel because the word excessive isn't necessarily your word. It's in the statute already, and you're using it here, and I wondered, is that just readily understood what that means? I'm wondering what is excessive. Then my question for you, Doctor, is what would be excessive for a pregnant woman?
Well, that is a difficult question because in terms of research, they haven't really been able to find a threshold that they think is harmless about drinking.
Harmless.
But so that, you know, you can't safely say to anyone, well, if you just drink one drink every once in a while, that'll be fine. You really don't know that. But we do know certainly that if a woman takes 3 to 5 drinks in an evening, that that's definitely teratogenic. I mean, meaning that that can cause real damage to the brain that they're quite sure of. But they don't know of any level that they can say with assurance that, oh, that's safe. Even though some people try to say that, they really don't know scientifically that there's any safe level at all.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, if I might, I'm displaying my ignorance about FAS. I mean, I know what it is, but is there any time during a pregnancy when it's worse or acceptable, or is there a time, well, I guess, is it worse if it's in the first trimester?
Well,
Karas.
No, there is some research to say that if a woman really drinks excessively during the first trimester, it pretty much messes up all the materials that are going to go on for the rest of the rest of the pregnancy. But in fact, you know, if you think about it, you know, once the program of pregnancy is on, there's a process being developed really constantly. There's, you know, all different kind of hormonal systems, all kinds of wiring going on in the brain, and that at whatever point in time that alcohol is in the system, whatever part of the brain system is developing in that time can be damaged. And so that there's all kinds of varieties of things that can get ruined or hurt in some way during the pregnancy and cause a whole variation of the damage by the time, you know, the child is born. So there's no safe time, and, you know, they're all dangerous times, in fact, because something's going on. It's sort of like with thalidomide. If you remember in the old days, if a woman used this medicine during the first trimester, it caused all these deformities in the children's arms. But if they say if they used it in the third trimester, it wouldn't have done anything because the arms are already developed. So if you stop this thing that hurts a thing, if you use it once the thing's already formed, it doesn't cause any more harm. But the brain's developing every second during pregnancy.
Thank you.
Any other questions for the witness? Senator Neville.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not sure if this is for the witness or Senator Betzel, but I'll ask it while they're both there. I'm just trying to figure out how this fits in because we have a current statutory definition of chemically dependent person that includes pregnant women engaged in habitual or excessive use during pregnancy, but this bill defines it differently. And I'm trying to figure out why we're not just tying into the current definition of chemically dependent person. It seems like it would cover the scenario that you're describing here.
Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Neville. The problem is that the current definition sets a pretty high standard threshold, if you will, of what it would take to commit somebody as chemically dependent. That is, it has to be habitual and excessive, danger to self or others, inability to provide for your basic needs of food, shelter, clothing, medication. The pregnant women who Dr. Karros are describing don't quite meet that threshold. They drink, but not to the level that they're necessarily endangering themselves or others. They might be endangering the fetus. Let's set that aside for a second. But some may be living on their streets, but able to provide for their basic needs otherwise. And so trying to just go the normal civil commitment route probably won't work. And actually this issue came to my attention from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office that actually looked at trying to civilly commit the women that some of the women that we're talking about, and they just said they don't meet the standard. We can't do it, so we have to find some other way. And that's where I came upon the idea of, well, maybe we could lower the standard a bit, use the early intervention part just for a short period of time. And the doctors who, as I say, have an interest in this said, well, we think that'll be better than what we've got right now, which is nothing.
Senator Neville.
I have several more follow-up questions, but to the doctor, since the definition here takes out the word habitual, so that we're only talking about excessive, so, yeah. And your testimony is that we're talking mostly about the danger to the fetus in the first 3 months. I thought you said that that's when most of the damage to the brain occurs. If somebody's using alcohol, it would probably be during the... there's no real threshold for alcohol, no safe time for alcohol use, but you're most concerned in the first 3 months.
Well, in terms...
Karros.
Thank you. There is some research saying that if someone drinks very heavily during the first trimester, that that's extremely damaging. But I wanted to qualify that by saying that if someone doesn't drink at all during the first trimester but drinks in the second and third, they can cause a great deal of damage. So okay. I just want to emphasize that it's not okay. None of the times are good, okay. And they still cause damage.
Thank you. That's a good clarification. So how would a doctor like you or others, how would you make the call then, the decision as to when the use is excessive that we could – in effect, lock somebody up for 14 days against their will.
Dr. Karros.
In my mind, it would be that if a woman has admitted to using, despite knowing the dangers, that already that's excessive. That doesn't mean that I want to commit her immediately, but that what I would do at that point would be to reinforce the message, encourage some treatment, encourage some support. And if that failed, you know, if she was just totally in denial about that being a problem, then I'd be looking, you know, I'd be starting to frantically look around for what were the options. And like I said, it would be sort of a last resort piece where I'd say, you know, if you're going to continue to use despite knowing the dangers, then you need this support.
It is. Dang. Sorry about that.
Sorry, everybody.
Please continue.
And if I could, I'd like to add, actually I'm a pediatrician, so that I see a lot more of the actual effects. I direct the clinic that has this whole prenatal thing, but I do about 300 fetal alcohol syndrome evaluations a year in conjunction with the University of Minnesota. And half of those kids are from the court system, you know, the juvenile justice and so on, so that this is a, you know, we have to also keep in mind the very pressing piece on the other side, where we have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of children who are damaged, who do not do well in school, who are behavior problems, end up in the court system, and cause a great deal of misery and harm to themselves, their family, society as a whole. So it's not just an issue of, gee, is this an issue for how different is this to deal with a mom, so much as to keep in mind the danger on the other hand. I mean, I think it always needs to be respectful and caring, but it should be seen as a help, a desperate measure for a very desperate situation in our society.
Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
Two more questions. In terms of the procedural due process, Senator Betzold, you understand this area better than I do, but if a doctor believed that there was excessive use, presumably they would contact somebody with the county. There'd be assuming that the direct intervention didn't work. Then there'd be a petition that could be filed by the county attorney. And tell me how the due process will be satisfied here in terms of this is not a commitment. It's just an intervention, so there's a maximum time that can be held. Could you work me through
sure.
that?
Sure.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair and Senator Neville, the process is this. If somebody feels that somebody needs protection of the court, the county attorney is usually the place that takes the initial information. Each county is required to have what's called a pre-petition screening program. That is, independent professionals who are skilled in the diagnosing and understanding mental illnesses, chemical dependencies, and they initially go out and evaluate the case at the start, and they file a report, and they offer their own opinions as to whether or not they think that a civil commitment process is appropriate or valid. Many cases, frankly, are resolved at that stage because they're not appropriate or they just find some other resolution. But that's the first step of the government. Then if the county attorney's office believes that the standards can be proved but by clear and convincing evidence, that's the standard, then they would file the petition. A court would appoint an attorney for the respondent. If the person is in such imminent danger that the person is a danger to self or others, then the court can order the person be held in a hospital. And typically what happens is a person starts in a hospital, and the doctor slaps a hold on the patient, and the patient's already in the hospital, frankly, by the time the thing starts. But the court has the opportunity to review and decide whether there should be a judicial hold for a hospital. Then the law requires that there has to be an initial court hearing within 72 hours, exclusive of Saturdays, Sundays, and holidays, so that we don't just forget about the person in the hospital. So the court has to have the hearing and make an initial determination as to whether the person should be held. Then there will be a trial if the matter is not settled, and it usually happens fairly quickly. It can be delayed up to 14. It has to be within 14 days. It can be delayed longer if there's good cause shown. But these things do happen rather quickly, and as I say, when the judge has to make the decision, it's a rather high standard that has to be satisfied before the judge can decide that the person's liberties should be taken away.
Well, and
Senator Neville.
And then if the judge issues the order for early intervention, is there a maximum time that this can be good for? Because it is short of a commitment.
That's correct.
And Senator Betzel.
The normal commitment, the judge doesn't decide how long the treatment is going to be. That's up to the doctors. But the law says that the person can be sent into treatment. And then if the person is still there after 60 to 90 days, there has to be a report generated. If the person is still there after 6 months, then there has to be another court hearing. That is not the case in early intervention. And as I say, if you look at the packet from Ms. Pontius's, and I'm trying to find it. If you look at the very last page, court ordered early intervention. This is 253B.066. Subdivision 1, if the court orders early intervention, the court may include a variety of alternatives. Short-term hospitalization not to exceed 21 days. So this is considerably shorter than the 6 months that would normally be available in another commitment.
So, Madam
Senator
Chair,
Neville.
So if presumably a woman in this case could be hospitalized for 21 days, and then if she didn't cooperate or if she went out again and continued to drink, then you'd go to a civil commitment?
Madam Chair and Senator Neville, if the county attorney wanted to pursue a civil commitment, again, they would have to show the much higher standard of habitual and excessive use of drugs or alcohol, danger to self or others, inability to provide for basic needs. And if they could show that at the start, they wouldn't even be looking at this early intervention. They would just go for the normal civil commitment. The problem that we have here, of course, is that some of the individuals that Dr. Karras is describing don't quite meet that standard. That's why we are suggesting in the bill a lower threshold, but also a shorter period of time under which the court would have jurisdiction.
Senator Betzel.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for Senator Betzold or the doctor?
Madam Chair, I do know that we have some people here who have an interest in the bill. Quite interestingly, the last time I had the bill, we had some opposition from the Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life because they were afraid that some women, you know, who would be facing commitment might have abortions to avoid commitment. I haven't heard from them, and now I have some opposition from NARO, the pro-choice group. So I've never had a bill that has had it work out that way before, but apparently they have some issues that they wish to address. So.
So if there's anybody in the audience who would like to come forward, please come to the table.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Please state your name
for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Melissa Reed. I'm the political director for NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota, and I'm more than happy to provide you with the entertainment and finding out that both organizations are coming at it from possibly a similar perspective. I don't have any written testimony today prepared for the committee. I do have a one-page handout that I would like to provide the committee, just outlining some of our concerns regarding the legislation. We do believe that it is an absolutely well-intentioned piece of legislation. Thank you. I myself used to work for many years in a community health care center, worked with many drug and alcohol dependent teens and adult mothers who were pregnant and some even trying to get pregnant in that state. So I absolutely understand the intention behind the legislation, but we are concerned, of course, with some of the potential violations of civil liberties, federal law, and some constitutional issues as well regarding it. So if any members of the committee do have any questions regarding the handout that's going around, I'd be more than happy to answer them at this time. But again, I don't have any solid prepared testimony, and I'd be more than happy to meet with any members outside of this hearing regarding any questions you may have.
Questions to the witness from members of the committee? Senator Betzold, what would you like to do with your bill?
Well, Madam Chair, I had my office just check with Senator Marty's office, and typically commitment bills have gone to the Health Committee in addition to this committee. Senator Marty is familiar with the bill because he was on Judiciary Committee. It was heard before. He said he does not need to see it. I believe in the past we have, last time it was heard, there were concerns about some possible fiscal costs here. Senator Berglund had an interest in seeing it before, so I think to be on the safe side, I would like to have it moved to the Finance Committee. If Senator Berglund decides that, you know, there, if we do a fiscal note and decide there isn't anything there, then she can, we can find a way to send it to the floor then. So I'll move that Senate File 322 be recommended pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Any discussions? Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, I have a couple of technical things to clarify. On line 1.7, subdivision 5, it says the court shall order early intervention, and then you added C. Then if you go to C on the back, line 2.6, it says the court may order early intervention. So we're saying shall in one place and may in another.
But they deal with two different things.
No, I think A incorporates C. Doesn't it? Am I reading it
well,
wrong?
Well, and again,
Senator Betzold.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Neville, I think that the language in C being, it's permissive, it sets forth, it doesn't require the court to order early intervention or commitment, and of course the courts are never required to do that. The subdivision 5 was basically written for mental illness commitments, because we just didn't perceive that there would be a middle ground with chemical dependency. The slippery slope wasn't there. Either you met the standards or you didn't. So it was, the idea was it's the person who was kind of going downhill and needed to be kind of hooked in the hospital. That's where we said the court shall order early intervention. But so I don't know if we're grinding gears here. You know, the shall that you've identified in the first part with may, I think the courts would still hone in on the language of subparagraph C. The court may order it if it finds. You know, we're not requiring the court to do anything, but we're permitting the court to do it if these standards are met. So
it's your intent anyway that this be permissive, not mandatory.
Yeah, I don't. The courts are going to do whatever they want, but this gives them the opportunity to do so if they're so inclined.
And then, Madam Chair, another point of clarification on line 1.13. In paragraph B, we actually state that these factors have to be proved by clear and convincing evidence. And you've stated that that's your intent for C, but that language isn't actually in C, like it is in B.
Senator Betzel. Well,
And Madam Chair, and perhaps Ms. Pontius can add to this, there's a number of there's quite an extensive case law in the civil commitment area that says that the courts have to follow the clear and convincing standard in order for civil commitment, because it is a deprivation of liberty. Preponderance of evidence is not sufficient. It has to, if you're going to deprive somebody of their liberty, it has to be clear and convincing evidence. So okay, whether it's stated here in this paragraph or not, that's still what the courts are going to say.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd like to move then on line 2.6 after the word fines to insert by clear and convincing evidence.
Yeah. And I have no,
just to be inconsistent.
I have no problem with that. That's the law.
So, Ms. Pontius, can you repeat that?
Madam Chair, members, on page 2, line 6, after fines, insert by clear and convincing evidence.
That's the law. So.
Senator Betzel moves.
Senator Neville moves.
The correction that counsel just stated. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
That's all the questions I have. Thank you.
Senator Foley.
I'm really concerned about where he's heading and the type of legislation that will produce out of this. I don't think that anyone that's ever worked in a psych ward or has never been out front and had a family member that was in one of those, why you wouldn't be at a rush to commit somebody. And I don't see why, when the doctor now can do a 72-hour hold, and there are ample things to take them beyond that if there's a real need. So I guess I'd have to say that I do not support this, and I would recommend it not pass.
Any other discussions? Seeing none, Senator, is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on the bill? Right. Seeing none, Senator Betzel renews his motion that Senate File 322, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
The motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you, members, ma'am. I think this completes our work for the day. I appreciate your willingness to stick around as we wait for the doctor to show up. We're going to start to have increasingly more bills in the committee. I promise you that if you come, I will try to give us all a little break in between where it's natural. But I think that starting from here on, we will probably be here till about 6 o'clock. So adjust your schedules. And if it would help me tremendously if you are going to be late or if you're not going to be coming, to please give us a call. My staff has been, we've been concerned about not making quorum, and we've had to start the meeting a little bit late, which is all right because I know people are coming from other places. But my staff have had to call committee members ahead of time, and then once committee starts, they've had to make a couple of rounds of call, and we've had indications that the members on their way, but, you know, it's taken a while. So please just, if you can't be here, you're going to be late, do let us know so we can plan accordingly. Thank you very much, and the committee is adjourned.